inviting me, or thank you for Cliff inviting me. Who's
no,
he's in Morion. He's gone to the ski conference. Yes, he invited me and then he couldn't come. I know. Okay, well, what I'm going to do is to talk about some work I've done a little bit on the cosmology of Galileans coupled to matter, looking perhaps at the speed of gravitational waves in Galilean theories, and finally, if I get round to it, the shape dependence of the screening. Now, the last time I talked here, I talked on something a bit different, but I barely got past the first page of notes, so I don't really know how far I'll get. Well, I know, this is. I think that's what the hockey stick's for. That's what Cliff told me. So, we've seen that the universe is undergoing an accelerated expansion today. Why? Well, it could be the cosmological constant, in which case I can go home. Or it could be just a quintessence theory. If it's quintessence, this is having a non-trivial kinetic term of a scalar field. The scalar field rolls down a potential. And the old quintessence models did not have the quintessence field coupled to matter. But by quantum corrections, they would if we could compute them. So it's more reasonable to consider actually a modified gravity theory if you want to consider a dynamical dark energy. You can modify gravity on large scales. And we know that the dark energy, or modified gravity, whatever it is around 70% of the observed energy density in the universe, with ordinary matter only around 5% and dark matter 25%. I mean, these things sort of change depending on exactly the precision of the CMB, but I've got the... Actually, I think that is the Planck the data. It might not be the most recent paper. But, you know. Now, if you... So I'm going to modify gravity with a scalar field. And if you modify gravity, you have to be very, very careful. Gravity doesn't just operate at long distance, it operates short distance, it operates on all scales, and it's tightly constrained. It's constrained by solar system tests of gravity. It's constrained by solar system tests. And one of the most accurate tests of gravity is the Cassini satellite. This is looking at the rings of Saturn, and they realized that they could test general relativity by looking at light bending around the sun on its way to us. This will actually constrain any modification. So if I write down the Newton potential as the normal 1 over r potential plus a modification, depending on a coupling parameter, beta, and the scale. So the Cassini satellite constrains beta squared, to be around 10 to the minus 5. I don't have the relevant photograph, but you can just put in a scale and test over test over distances.
Yeah, no, I'm just wondering whether, whenever I see these things, they're usually an exponential modification.
Yeah. This is the range. This is the range. So lambda would be the range of the force at some distance r.
Presumably the question is, that's true independent of what lambda is? Strange.
That's right, yes.
It has to be specifically a large lambda. Lambda is very small, then direct lambda.
Yeah. So, and the other test one has is the lunar ranging. I actually find the lunar ranging phenomenal. People know that. Okay, I won't explain it then. I don't have a transparency, but I find it phenomenal that they had the foresight when they landed on the moon to put mirrors there. And they were originally testing the distance, the Earth-Moon distance, with laser light on Earth, firing at the moons. They put three mirrors. They only, in the last few years, located the third mirror. And you can test now general relativity with the lunar ranging. You know, I really, really like it. So anyway, whatever we do with modified gravity, we need to make sure we do not violate solar system constraints. So we need some sort of screening. If I were to write down the action and linearize around a configuration, I can write the screening mechanisms like this. And I've written them all here. We could either have some non-trivial kinetic terms with this Z factor, having some sort of mass that depends on the scalar field, or a coupling to matter that depends on a scalar field around the background field. And these are three different screening mechanisms. When I was last here, I talked about this one, which is the chameleon mechanism, whereby the mass of the chameleon depends on the environment so that it's heavy or heavier in a dense environment and very light cosmologically. So it acts as essentially an effective dark energy particle cosmologically, but it's short range in the solar system. What I'm talking about today is this one, where the coupling to matter is reduced by increasing the Z factor. This leads to non-linearities in the kinetic term. This one's actually my favorite, where you reduce the coupling to matter because in a sort of Damour-Polyakov, because there's a sort of dilaton model you can cook up, but I could never quite derive it from string theory.
Could you derive anyone else from a string theory?
I have occasionally discussed. You need a special string theorist, to be honest, to say, look, I'm playing around with a chameleon or an environmentally dependent dilaton. I've got the potential for the dilaton, but I don't know the coupling. Can we sort of think about this? Because most string theorists like to sit down and they like to be in extra dimensions. And when you say, well, actually, I'm only in four dimensions, please. So the one string theorist I did talk to about this, we kind of didn't get very far. You know, my friends in Cambridge are not phenomenological enough to think about it, except Fernando, who's got taken away to Trieste. So,
can I ask you just a little bit more what that T is? It's not the energy momentum tensor, it's just standing in for some.
It is the matter coupling. I'm sorry, yes, it is the energy momentum tensor.
And it does have a delta.
Okay, well, I'm looking around a background configuration. So this is the matter. It will become the matter.
Okay. I think that's, I understand whether it's delta T or just T. That would be used for tripping a couple. So all of the matter?
It's all of the matter. It is all of the matter, Andrew.
What keeps me from just redefining my phi to absorb that factor?
I'm sorry, pardon?
What keeps me from just redefining phi to absorb a z factor?
I'll show you in a minute.
Okay.
So the one I'm going to talk about is where you've got the z factor, which depends on phi. And this gives you a Weinstein mechanism. And what this does is that when you write down the full Lagrangian rather than linearizing, the Lagrangian is highly non-linear in the kinetic terms. And I will write it down in all its glory, but won't analyze it.
Right. Isn't it a little bit misleading to say that then it just depends on phi? It also depends on its derivatives, right?
Yes, it does. Okay. So yes.
Maybe that's the sort of
that's, yes. Okay, I'm sorry, yes. This is linearizing, okay?
But that formula is set up by not.
Yeah, in that yeah. Formula, it looks like a
yeah, I know. It's I should probably shouldn't use that. Okay. So what the Weinstein mechanism does is it changes the effective Newton potential depending on both Z and beta. And Z is written in some theories because it's got higher order terms here. If you take a Galilean theory, there's an invariance under d mu phi goes to d mu phi plus c mu, where c is a constant. And the Lagrangian I'm going to write down here. And this is why I will only write it down once. Actually, I'll write it down twice, I'm sorry. So here, we've got standard kinetic term, bog standard kinetic term, with a constant c2. Then we've got a third order term here. L4 stands for the fourth order term written down in gory detail here. L5. And these are the couplings to matter. We can either couple directly to the trace of the energy momentum tensor with some constant times phi t, or we can use a disformal coupling, coupling to t mu nu with the derivatives. And I've got this in its generality. Now, if I sit down and compute the equations of motion of this, when I compute the equations of motion of this term, I only get second order derivatives. If I compute the equations for motion of this term, I get second order derivatives and this term. Because the way that this is constructed, the kinetic term is highly nonlinear, but the equations of motion are just second order. Which is, so there's no ghosts here. And another thing to note is that these two terms, the scalar field couples to the Ricci. So we get some sort of interaction between the scalar field and gravity directly there. What else? I'm going to take a cosmological scale for lambda because I'm interested in dark energy. And what I'm going to do, I think my collaboration is the only one that does this, I'm going to ask for a Minkowski limit. So I'm going to take C2 to be positive. So this, in fact, I'm going to take C2 to be a 1. So this, the kinetic term is just the usual half d mu phi squared. And then all the other parameters are normalized with respect to that. So what we then do is one puts this into a FRW background and you demand that the theory in FRW is ghost-free. This gives you the relationship between the parameters that you have to satisfy. I'm not going to write this down because because with this nonlinear thing, it takes up a few pages. Well, it's a bit complicated.
And were you going in gravitational back reaction here?
Yes. Initially, yes.
Okay.
Now,
can I just quickly ask you, please, slide? What's the next two terms?
Matter species. Matter species. So this could be baryons, it could be, because I've got this coupling in as well, it could be photons, it could be baryons, it could be dark matter. It's a finite number of species. So let me just call this ordinary matter, ordinary matter, photons, and dark matter would be.
Allowing it to couple distinctly to each of those.
Yeah. There's a reason for that. So I've got slightly ahead of myself. If we sit down and compute the first two terms, just this term, in a spherically symmetric background, we find that it's got a solution for the gradient of the field. The gradient of the field gives rise to a fifth force. And what one finds, so the gradient is written here, where r star, this is called the Weinstein radius, such that inside this radius r star, the nonlinearities will screen the fifth force, but outside they're unscreened. And the Weinstein radius for the most bodies on the solar system is actually rather large when we put the parameters in, so that we screen the fifth force in the solar system, but not cosmologically. It's easy to do for C3. You can just sit down in spherical symmetry. You can sit down and do it analytically. For the others, it's a bit more difficult. Now, Andrew asked what I was. So I did say that it's the matter species. And the reason I've put I down rather than just saying T is because when we couple this field to matter, let's look at this one. This, if it couples to photons, it can give rise to a change of the speed of light. And C0, if it couples to baryons, could change the baryonic mass. So we have to look at variations of the speed of light with coupled to baryons and look at LHC constraints on both C0 and CG. I can satisfy those. So when it's coupled to ordinary matter, we can satisfy the constraints that actually my collaborators calculated in a different work. But I can leave it varying as an arbitrary parameter coupled to dark matter. And we then essentially looked at the cosmology. We imposed in an FRW background that there were no ghosts, which constrains the...
So you said lambda to be cosmological. So what value are you thinking about?
Oh, I wrote it down. It's just we've chosen it to be lambda Q to be H0 squared M Planck.
Okay, so you want me to do it in my head?
Okay.
No, I'm just wondering because, this is a cutoff of the theory. So.
It's a cutoff of the theory.
And
what we're trying to do is to have this as a dark energy particle,
yeah.
So we can get the right equation of state, we can get this as a dark energy, and then look at the effects.
No, I guess my concern is that since this is an effective theory, then it has a cutoff, it is presumably low because it's cosmological. So I don't see how you can apply to LHC, because... If you make C small, the whole theory...
Okay, I wasn't involved in looking at the variation of particle masses from LHC constraints, so I don't know the full details.
Okay.
But when we collaborated, we took the constraints that they'd already derived.
Yes, I guess what I'm worried is you may just use the three-level interactions, but then you don't necessarily
trust them. To be perfectly honest, I think it's okay because I'm sure that Philippe Brax and Claire Burridge would have thought of this as cosmology and then checked the constraints. But I can't tell you the details because it wasn't my work. I can tell you what I did.
You can't tell the difference.
No, but the point is that this is an effective theory, right?
It's an effective theory.
And most of these cutoffs are either millimeter or more than that. Yeah, you may make sphere small so that you have a small cross section or decay rate to matter, but I mean the rest of the theory becomes just kind of coupled up. Okay.
So
yeah.
The cutoff that we get from cosmology of quantics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's our cutoff. So what we then did is to impose the no-ghost relation in FRW.
Sorry, just to check. By ghost, you mean take the solution, perturb it, and take it quadratic with their own negative energy moment?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. We checked that it has not just a sensible Minkowski limit, but a sensible FRW limit. And this constrains relationships between the parameters, which I am not writing down because they're too long. And then everything else is essentially done with Maypole or Mathematica. You impose that the speed of sound is positive, which sounds reasonable enough, or C squared, I should say, and then explore the parameter space. And we had an enormous difficulty actually fitting the theory. When we looked at the literature, people either do embodied simulations and they don't actually include the coupling to matter, and we didn't know why, and they then include that C2 has the wrong sign. And, well, it's a cosmology, so it doesn't matter what sign it has. But my own feeling is that this is an effective field theory, and if it comes from something else, then it has to have the right sign. It has to have a Minkowski limit. But maybe I'm old-fashioned. So we had enormous difficulty, but we eventually fitted it. What we have is that the particle is doesn't couple very strongly to ordinary matter, but it does couple to dark matter. And so there's a difference between its coupling to, so it's not a universal coupling to both, to all matter, which I don't particularly like, but that's what came out. And
the best fit to get the right growth is not a universal coupling.
Yeah.
You're constraining the coupling.
So
you're constraining the coupling?
So yeah. Yes. So we've got the variation of the Hubble parameter with respect to Z, and this actually has the right value today, but there's a variation in the dim and distant past. This is the equation of state, so it's dominating today, approximately minus one today, but not in the dim and distant past. And we also constrained, looked at the variation of G Newton, and it's, so this is what happens in the distant past, and this is actually within bounds, the bounds, everything here is within the experimental bounds. If it didn't satisfy experimental bounds, we threw it out. And this would be the variation on the speed of light.
Would that fit the CMB if you take
yeah.
G Newton?
I think so, Niash. I'm sure we satisfied whatever constraints we could find, because we had some difficulty constraining the theory.
And could you run the CMB codes with this? I mean, this,
oh God.
That does require some some time.
Well, I wouldn't know how to. I don't think anybody in this collaboration... Oh, I don't know, actually. One person might. Oh, no. No, I don't know. To be honest, I don't even know if the CMB code has been run for Galileons,
yeah.
Per se. Uh-huh. Because the people I know who do embody tend to look at large-scale structure, and I don't think they've looked at CMB.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems that, I mean, 50% sounds like a big...
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Can I ask about the previous slides?
Sure.
So looking at the right hand plot, that's the equation of state.
This is the equation of state. As a function of redshift.
To reach exactly minus one at exactly the present era where z equals zero. Was that because you designed it sort of automatically as long as CDN today? Because it looks like if you continue, it's going
yeah.
to shift way down to negative double U.
Actually, it doesn't.
But
I can't remember the exact ones, but we did find that if we weren't careful, we got singularities in the future.
What's wrong with that?
Well, you see, I.
Some of us think it's an issue.
Well, it's sufficiently far in the future that, you know, exactly. So, you know.
I guess I'm asking the fact that you have W equals minus one to present day, is that enforced by your prior theoretical assumption, or is that being enforced by the data?
We were searching. We were searching for an equation of state to be within bounds of something like, you know, within, we were searching for it to be, I think, within 10% of minus one today.
We've got an answer which looks like a fraction of
10%. Yeah, I know. This is the best fit. So we were searching the parameter space. So we got an equation of state today that looked like it would satisfy the experimental bounds.
But
and
it's
didn't
not really the case though, because the bounds don't they sort of tend to either take a constant W or some particular variation. And so really you want to fit over the sort of, you know, Z down to whatever, two or three. You want to
this fits it, Ruth.
Yeah.
This fits it. So we were fitting thing. We were searching for a solution that would give us the cosmology that was consistent with what we know, with a Minkowski limit, and we got it. I can't say I believe it, but we got it. And the reason, and then so here we have it, and we search the parameters, and we find this is a search of parameter space of both the coupling to dark matter and C3. And we found that it is really, the shaded regions are on the attractor. And, you know, it's highly constrained to get a sensible cosmology. But you can do it. And, you know, the first thing we thought when we first started this was, well, why on earth are people taking values of the ordinary quadratic term to have the wrong sign? And when we started to look for what we wanted, we understood why they did it, because it's easier to satisfy constraints. But we didn't want to do that, because all of us come from a particle physics background. Okay, now, when we go back, if we take another look at the Lagrangian, see if I can get it up. When we consider this term, we've got the Galilean coupling to the Ricci. So if the Galilean couples to the Ricci, it can change the speed of the it can have a difference between the speed of light and the speed of gravitational waves. So we then need to consider that and what that does. And when we did this, it was a bit academic, but it's no longer academic. So taking our solution and trying to see what we could do, we can compute the limits on the speed of tensor modes. One thing is, it's if the tensor mode is less than the photon speed, then cosmic rays can emit gravitons by Cherenkov radiation, and this will slow them down. And we know that then this will constrain, if CT is less than C, this to be one part in 10 to the minus 17 from the speed of from cosmic ray physics. If CT is greater than C, then this can affect the period of binary pulsars. And this constrains the limit to be 10 to the minus 2, the ratio. So there's limits on this. And when we started to play with this, we looked at whether we would Weinstein screen the gravitational waves. So the Weinstein screening will come in if the derivative of the fourth order term is very small. And when you compute this, I'm afraid it's for objects that are less than the solar system, than the solar mass. So as soon as we couple the Galileon to the Ricci, we then really need to consider the speed of gravitational waves. And the thing I've neglected to say is that if we want an equation of state to be minus one today, we need to have the fourth order term to be non-zero. You don't get the acceleration of the universe today with just the cubic Galileon. So
you're forbidding a straight cosmological process? You're not allowing a straight cosmological process.
No. So what I was doing, when I got this equation of state here, I had no cosmological constant. And the only way we could get, the fifth order term in the Galilean Lagrangian doesn't do very much. But the fourth order term is necessary to get an accelerating universe today. To get an accelerating universe, per se. If you just have the third order term, the Galilean is subdominant and you need a cosmological constant. So, we checked that the sort of bodies that we could suppress the fourth order term in, and really found that it's less than a solar mass, which, okay, could be useful for some things, but not for most things. So I'm afraid we then looked at the constraints, having a very small fourth order term, having the Galilean subdominant, and limiting on the speed of gravitational waves. So this is our plot. With our parameters, we were getting that CT, the tensor mode, was always greater than one. And I was being sort of a bit old fashioned, I'm normalizing the photon speed to be one. Maybe we should rethink this now. But so CT was always bigger than one. And, well, so CT is bigger than one. What happens? We can consider that if the gravitational waves move faster than the speed of light, do they lose energy? So the gravitational wave could decay into photons, and this would then mean it would lose energy. So let's look at the decay. We stick the numbers in, and this is actually longer than the age of the universe. So that's not much good. So then we looked at gravitational Cherenkov radiation. And again, this this decay is also of the age of the universe. So again, as soon as we start to have CT greater than the speed of light, we need to consider the constraints. We can't just say, well, it will decay, it'll damp.
Greater than the age of the universe or shorter than the age of the universe?
It's greater than the age of the universe.
So that doesn't happen?
It doesn't happen.
Okay.
It doesn't happen. I'm sorry, sorry?
You had a slide where you showed the constraint at 10 to the minus 17. Was that after this demo?
I think that was if it was less than, the CT was less than 1.
Ah, yes. So, yeah. So, for. So there was sort of people said, oh, well, CT could be less than 1. What happens there? Yeah, but what we found is that CT is greater than 1 in our work. So then, if CT is greater than 1, we could consider how to test it. There could be a time delay if you see both gravitational waves and photons or neutrinos. Neutrinos come almost at the speed of light. So you can test then the time delay. And we looked at various binaries or supernova, and what we would need in order to be able to test whether there's a time delay. You have to have the... If you have a supernova too far away, then the time delay is so big that you wouldn't associate it with the same event. So you need to have it fairly close so you can associate it with the same event and measure the time delay. So we've looked at a supernova kiloparsec away and looked at perhaps the sort of time delay and whether we would constrain CT. Now, of course, what we know now, and we didn't know when we wrote this paper, is this one. So we've now seen gravitational waves from the binary black hole. It's beautiful work. Phenomenal. And if Fermilat observed the same event, then this is putting the... this is constraining CT to be 10 to the minus 17, I think.
Again, you're assuming that the electromagnetic counterpart was produced at the same time as the original wave?
Yes. If that's what happened, yes. I don't know if that's true. I mean,
no one knows if this is real.
No one knows if this is real. So if this is correct, what we do know is that when Virgo comes online, there's going to be three arms and you can triangulate. And then that will be a much better test of the speed of gravity. So until we've got Virgo online, I don't think we can really test it. But it's... Is it this summer? I think it's this summer Virgo's coming online.
Somewhere in September.
Yeah. So, you know, we will be able to test this theory. And the final thing I wanted to talk about, I didn't think I was going to get this far with, is the shape dependence. This is work that I did with Julian Bloomfield and Claire Burridge. It sort of came about with people talking about, oh, you know, Galilean screening, the Einstein radius is really large. And if you sit down and compute the Weinstein radius for different shapes, you find you get different results. And of course, astrophysical bodies are not all spherical. We first noticed this when we looked at a planar solution. I think we were looking for lab tests, actually, I'm wondering if you might be able to detect something in a Casimir-type experiment where you've got a planar solution. And if you put, if you start to compute what happens for a planar solution for this term, for this term, for this term, in a planar geometry, you find that the nonlinear terms cancel term by term, exactly. So you don't get Feinstein screening for a planar geometry. And then we sort of started to look with Julian at various other geometries. So the planar case, there is no screening. The fifth force is unscreened, so it just depends on the coupling. If you want to test this, you need to find an environment where you can, you're outside the Feinstein radius of the Earth. We kind of thought whether we could do it in a, as I say, in the Casimir, but I think we're screwed by the Feinstein radius of the Earth, but I'm not 100% sure. For the cylindrical symmetry case, the fifth force is less screened than in the spherical case. So it's just got a 1 over RV screening. And for the spherical case, it's 1 over RV squared. So to test, so one can consider testing Feinstein screening in environments different from spherical symmetry. You know, can you observe a fifth force in some astrophysical environment? We also sort of did it for, of this case, must be just using the third order term because it's an analytic expression. We did it, sort of plotted it out numerically for the full system. And yeah, so this is the cylindrical Galilean. The spherical is this one for cubic. And then we considered the quartic term coming in, and also a DBI type of kinetic term. So are there ways in which one might see the fifth force coming from a Galilean in some sort of environment that we haven't looked at? So what I thought about is whether you could try to see some sort of gas stream where you'll get approximate planar symmetry. But then, of course, it can't be in a cluster because that's screened with the Feinstein screening of the cluster. So it had to be in some sort of void. And I don't know how to test it. But, you know, there should be some way that one could try to get this, to get to see some sort of effect of Feinstein screening or not. Extra forces over and above what you expect. So that's the sort of shape dependence.
Can I ask about the orbs of globular clusters in the Milky Way? Does that take place in approximately planar symmetry?
No. So if you have the globular, but isn't the globular cluster, would that be inside the Feinstein screening of the Milky Way?
Yes, that's what I'm asking. I have no idea how big the Feinstein screening is in the Milky Way.
What?
Probably, yes.
I think it's just inside the Feinstein radius of the Milky Way. Now, the but I'm not 100% sure.
I expect you
that. Yeah.
Oh, we've got it to Northwest.
Sorry?
How would galaxy merge?
I don't know.
I'm familiar not in this case, but in the case of scarization, scar tensor theories. But
yeah.
Once you get two objects individually, you could not keep that phenomenology. Once you get two objects, then you trigger the phase transition. So now you have maybe some delta signs in some galaxies that have undergone merger recently, as opposed to those that seem to be quite useful.
So something like the bullet cluster. Or, yeah, I mean, I'm not 100% sure, you know, but I'm just observing that the, you know, in different environments, the screening is much less than what has been assumed in the past. And that's about as far as I really know, because I keep thinking that I can't test this, but I don't know, you know, it's sort of, there may be other ways of doing it.
When you compute the Weinstein radius of the Milky Way, are you considering the Milky Way as being spherical?
Yes.
Which is not.
Which is not. True. Yes, you're quite right. You would need to put down the what the Milky Way looks like. Don't quite know how you'd do that, actually. But I think in the past, people would just say, oh, yeah, it's spherical, therefore it's screened.
What about the dark matter of the Milky Way? Is that a blob of stuff that we...
If the Weinstein radius is bigger than the dark matter halo of the Milky Way, then it's spherical, roughly.
Yeah.
You can compute how the multipole moments get screened. You could actually find that the tidal forces are far more screened than the radio potential. Kind of in a little bit of contradiction to what you're saying here, but I think that's just because here the assumption of cylindrical or planar symmetry is really a drastic departure from spherical symmetry. But perturbatively, if you just add some harmonics onto a mass distribution, you'll find that the tidal forces, which are actually more screened, that the tidal scalar forces compared to tidal gravitational.
But can you really get decent constraints? And it's going to be highly model dependent on what those different multiple moments are. We really know what they are. So in practice, how is it going to tell us anything useful?
Well, I think that's
I'm too pessimistic.
I think it's just saying that the spherically symmetric part of the signal is probably the most.
Yeah.
So if you can't see anything there, then not going to see anything.
Okay.
The non-spherical symmetric.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah, most environments I can think of, there's some sort of screening, and I don't see how I can test it. But, you know, I don't know all the astrophysical environments. So, I think. So, you know, really, you might say, what next? One thing that our work has shown is that you want to keep a Minkowski limit, then the Galileans, well, if they are the prime source of the acceleration of the universe, then they're giving us the speed of gravitational waves that is too large. In which case, they're subdominant on their own. If they're subdominant, can they be detected? I don't know. And what next? Well, one thing you could consider doing is relaxing the Minkowski limit. Now, for me, I'm not prepared to do that. I'd like to think that any theory I play with, I could, in principle, derive it from something more fundamental. But if you were to relax the Minkowski limit, you can get much further. Personally, I don't do that. And, you know, astrophysically, are there planar objects or something that are unscreened that I could observe a fifth force? Even if it's subdominant, it could still be there. And it's not quite so, you know, even if you have a theory with that's subdominant for the acceleration of the universe, you might expect that with a complicated higher dimensional theory, you're getting something that's bringing in an extra scalar field. So it's not such, you know, controversial saying, well, how do we detect this? You might find that some sort of nice string compactification gives you something weird. But I better not go on about that because I don't know what I'm talking about any more than that. So thank you very much. And I didn't expect to finish on time.
Can I press a bit more on the Minkowski limit? Two questions. One, I'll just ask one, but is there any observation you can point to that requires it to be a Minkowski limit, or is that entirely theoretical?
It's just theoretical, completely theoretical. I start with the ordinary quadratic term being the correct sign and, you know, 1/2 phi squared, phi dot squared.
Maybe I guess my second question. So you said that you wanted your theory to somehow come from some more fundamental thing.
Yeah.
To me, the Minkowski limit is a kind of very low energy effective something or other that might or might not emerge from some complicated thing.
Yeah. Well, it might be low energy, but it's relevant for, say, particle physics. Now,
well, if it was, then there would be a part of the observation that so you had to have it. You just set the
yeah. I mean, it seems reasonable that you got a normal quadratic term. So this is what I'm calling the Minkowski limit, that I can, if the other terms were subdominant, I'll just have d mu phi squared and, you know, something normal for a Klein-Gordon equation rather than a wrong sign Klein-Gordon equation. Now, that seems to me to be reasonable. And then I could think about this coming from some, you know, pro-brain theory, perhaps, which I think was probably done here, actually, by Clyde Durham and Andrew Tolley, when they showed that you can get this out from some pro-brain. Now...
So I guess I'm at this point I'm missing something. So you said that your theory doesn't have ghosts around the paradigms, right?
Yeah.
But then... So yeah, that's the whole reason that you set the sign of the kinetic term. So I mean, whatever you're doing, as long as it doesn't have ghosts, then there's nothing fundamental about the sign of the kinetic term. The reason we set it to whatever it is that it should happen.
Well, I said two things. I said I don't have ghosts in Minkowski space or in FRW. Actually.
Well, we live in the paradigm.
So,
well,
no, see,
FRW is not quite a Minkowski, so whatever it is, I don't know.
Well, no, it's a question of whether the, you know, Pythagorean theory is in that accurate,
yeah.
Or not.
I just
thought it would
be clear, but at least the beginning. So the theory starts with Galilean corrections to GR on order scale, or is it like a limit of some other theory that experimental scales reduces to Galilean? Sometimes they say, like, in the coupling limit or the that limit, you get back Galilean, for example, from massive gravity.
Yeah.
Or
just Galilean.
Yeah, just Galilean. I want the right side kinetic term is what I'm searching for. And then I need to search for the rest of my parameters so they're also ghost free.
But you were able to get it if I never consistent if I never
not sure. Okay.
So I just want to understand the status of the state. So the top statement, is that pre-LIGO or post-LIGO? you know, the announcement last month. Is that?
Oh, that's pre. That's essentially pre-LIGO.
Okay. So post-LIGO, is it worse? Right. There's no evidence gravity waves travel at anything different than the speed of light. So, this, I mean, you mentioned.
Well, there's no. I mean, unless you, if you, well, there's no. We don't know, do we? Because the only way we would know is if Fermilat actually observed a signal coming from the same source released at the same time, then we do know.
Well, we know how fast it took them to get from the one detector to the other.
Oh yeah, but that...
That's a short distance.
It's a short distance.
But...
So that doesn't constrain it enough.
Okay, so that's not enough. That's my... So,
yeah.
So then, I mean... So how subdominant can they be before Galileans become no longer an interesting or useful theoretical paradigm? I mean, how tightly, you know, I mean, this model, so far there's nothing in favor of it, to the best of my knowledge. So how tightly can it be constrained before people would say, well, this isn't worth the time? Or is that too premature a question?
Well... You.
I have no dog.
Okay, you have to take my proviso. If I want the kinetic term to be the right sign, then they. I think they're pretty constrained. Now, if you relax that, which I don't think you'd be prepared to do either.
Well.
But.
Probably not.
Yeah. You know. Same reason, you know, then, but you see, you know, if you relax that, then you can do it, I believe. I never investigated that parameter space, actually. Other people have, but I'm not sure they put in all the constraints. I don't know. So if that was relaxed, then you might still be able to do it. But if you have that, the constraint on the quadratic term, then, you know, to me it's looking very marginal.
Galileans with the proper Minkowski limit requirement are in real big trouble. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, I think so.
I can put some parameters on mass, among other parameters.
Yeah.
But that could change in here.
I mean, all of this is about to change. We've seen. Well, one event has been announced. There's more. There will be more. And, you know, it's going to be, I think, all of the gravity theories, you know, we're going to be testing them to whatever limit, I'm not quite sure, but it's really exciting. And we might find that there's not much room to maneuver. Well, for the chameleon-type theories, they don't affect the gravitational waves. There's no constraint there. It's only these things where you're getting the coupling between the scalar field and the Ricci that you're going to get a constraint. But as soon as you go to something that's non-linear like a Galilean, and I don't know, I was wondering about massive gravity, but I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
What is the size of the graviton mass?
So what it is, John, there's... Come back. Here. So it's a highly nonlinear theory with... this term is here, so it's a scalar field coupled to Ricci. It's this nonlinearities and the coupling to the Ricci, which is giving you something that's both screened, where a fifth force is screened, but it can affect the gravitational waves. It's not a graviton mass.
Okay.
or per se, no, it's not.
Right, thank you.
Okay, thank you.